Thank you, Chris. Well, the title is As Advertised. This is a plantation, and I'm going to take a slightly different tack, I think, than some of the other speakers. So I think it'll echo many of the points raised by the other speakers, particularly the first two speakers this morning. And I'm going to focus primarily not so much on Westwide, but what I know best, which is California, which is dominated largely by a Mediterranean climate, mild, wet winters, and points where Southern California burns up annually. So how do you get plantations? Well, one way, of course, is to harvest a forest and regenerate reforestation, and that's what we see on the left side, and that's largely industry land these days. Used to be almost anybody did it, but it's largely an industry phenomenon now. And the other way you get plantations, of course, is to have a catastrophic wildfire, and this is one that occurred in 2002 on the right. So both ways, if you want to reforest, you get plantations. And the common species that's planted is ponderosa pine, because essentially we know how it behaves. We get 98% survival commonly with ponderosa pine. And a good one might look typically like that, and one that's not so good might look typically like that, although both are fully stocked by any standard measures of stocking. So one would be managed relatively intensively, the other less intensively. And here's a typical example, and generally it's a dichotomy on who happens to be managing the land. And the one on the left is public. It's national forest land, Lassen National Forest, and there are two giveaways. One is they're standing dead trees, and so snag retention is a big deal on federal lands. And the other is there's not much done with the understory vegetation. So it was planted, and stuff came back. In this case, it's largely Ceanothus vellutinus. Dale Johnson's done a lot of work on that. It's nitrogen fixer. The stand on the right of the line is you don't see a lot of standing dead out there, but you see a lot of live green trees sticking up and not a lot competing with them. So that's a dichotomy between public and private land in general. But it doesn't. There's a dichotomy within the private sector as well. This is the Fountain Fire of 1992, and that's a nice line that we see as a division between two systems there. One is industrial land on the left, the other is non-industrial land on the right. They were both planted, but the industrial types got in and they logged 24/7 right around the clock for a year, salvage harvesting, and then they came in with the winged subsoilers and ripped on the contour, tilled on the contour, sprayed the field capacity with herbicides, and then planted trees. And the others, they planted trees and figured nature would take care of it. And this is pretty much what it looks like today. That's non-industrial forest on the right, lots of standing dead, lots of stuff that isn't trees in the understory, and a more actively managed plantation on the other side, both regenerated at the same time. So the question is, are there any incentives to practice active management in terms of carbon storage, or as Mark Johnson pointed out this morning, ecosystem services provided by some measure of management? So the question is, why do you even need incentives to manage a forest? Well, if you're going to plant a forest, isn't that incentive enough, you knowing you're doing good work? Well, one has to do with physical reality, and I tried to touch on that in my wild lecture yesterday. You got to face the facts, folks. There are forces out there that are shaping the way we do forestry. I thought it was an interesting exercise to look at the forest practices rule we have in four western states. Now, a lot of the states of the nation don't have Forest Practices Act. A lot of it is best management practice. We promise to do a good job and not dry up the swamp and to keep dirt out of the creek. But in the West, it's a little different story. We do have Forest Practices Act, and the average length of the number of pages in the Forest Practices Rule in Idaho just a couple of years ago was 25 pages. I don't know if that's changed much. Oregon is about three times that, four times that maybe, so that's still a lot of stuff to go through. Washington, more so. And can you pick up a trend here? We're coming to California. This is California, over 300 pages just in the Forest Practices Rules, and there was a reformation of the State Board of Forestry some years back, and now you go through many, many, many hoops to cut a tree down. And once you cut a tree down, you're required to file a timber harvest plan. And that has to be certified by a registered professional forester. And this is the average cost in thousands of dollars for an average timber harvest plan up through about 1992. And we can see that, well, you know, $6,000-$7,000, that's a fair amount of money. But if you're a big player, like Roseburg or Sierra Pacific, well, that's not a big deal. You got in-house people that can do it. If you're a non-industrial type, if they're me, for example, that has 40 acres of land and I just want to thin, I still have to pay for that to harvest a tree. Okay, things changed with the reformation of the State Board of Forestry in California. Now it's risen a little bit. New rules were adopted in 1993, and this is the average cost through the year 2005-ish. And as of this year, or late last year, the average cost, this is the average cost, and you know there's variation around that, was $40,000 to file a timber harvest plan to get approval by the state to harvest a tree, for whatever the purpose might be. And then you have to maintain stocking. And so there have to be incentives to practice active forestry in California, and that's my point. You say, well, who cares about California? Folks, there's a lot of people that live in California, and there's a lot of political clout. So what have we done about it? Well, we have a new governor, and we have developed a California Climate Action Registry, and that was mentioned this morning, and there's our, oh, cool, that's wrong. That's the old guy. Well, here's a new one. This is the post-steroid era. So we'll get rid of the old one there. So Arnie has been pretty progressive and pretty active, because I think he married well, and that was the whole trick to the thing. And we have what's known as a couple of important landmark legislations. One was Senate Bill 812, passed a few years ago, that essentially established a California Climate Registry. And that basically was a whole lot of people started signing up on that. And as of last time I looked, there were about 600 or 700 agencies or entities that signed on to the registry. And basically, they wanted to promise they were going to show ways in which they were reducing a carbon footprint or a greenhouse gas footprint. So that was followed up by a real toothy bill. Assembly Bill 32 was the California Global Warming Solutions Act. So we're going to solve the problem. You need to know that. And basically, that gets into elements of trading carbon. And of course, we all know that trading carbon has become a great cottage industry. And all you have to do is hit Google and ask for carbon trading or carbon brokerage. And I, as of last week, it was 500,000 hits on Google on that topic. And then if you go to Yahoo, which aims to be better and more powerful, you got almost 12 million hits on it. So whether you believe it or not, there's a lot of interest in carbon trading. So the question is there a role here in a populous state like California, which has 40% of the state is actually forested in one shape or another? Is there a role there for plantation management? So what I'm going to look now is some of the oldest sites that we have, oldest experiments in California where we've done some level of intensive management. And one of these is a place near Mount Shasta, which is not too far from where I live and where I rip lips on trout. If you look at the area on the far right up there, you see a cleared area, and that was taken probably back in the 60s. And that was a big brush field created by wildfire, stayed in brush for a long time, and then it was windrowed and planted the trees in the 60s, and we're going to focus on that. So here's a blow-up of that area on that old photograph, and you can see perhaps the windrows where the brush was pushed aside. Largely Arctostaphylos patula manzanita, not a nitrogen fixer. And then a series, this was about the time of the onset of Vietnam, so a whole series of herbicide treatments were tried there, and the object was to come up with what ultimately became Agent Orange in Vietnam, and there was a lot of stuff left behind, including different levels of brush density. And so one of our scientists clicked onto this sort of thing and put in a series of replicated field trials in which the sites were planted, and they were arranged in an array of from no understory brush to a lot of understory brush with a few things in between, and these were taken out manually for several years. One of my first summer jobs was working on this. So this is an ashy soil, volcanic ash, relatively recent origin near Mount Shasta. Precip is about 1,000 millimeters, not a real wet site. Really low site quality, about 14 to 18 meters at 50 years, judging from the tallest trees. So there's a light density plot taken back in the 1960s. And then recently I measured standing volume on these plots. Now we're about 30 years into the experiment. You can see that no brush competition, the big green bar on the left, you got a lot of big fat happy trees and they're doing like nobody's business. But over on the right where there's heavy understory brush from day one, it's only producing 11 cubic feet per acre, which isn't a lot. So what the heck does it look like? Well, this was photographed a couple of years ago, and so there's little Bobby standing in a stand that was free of understory brush from day one. and this is adjacent to it, literally 15 meters away. Same age trees, but it's got a lot of brush. Now the question is there really any difference in total carbon storage? One is relatively intensively managed, the other is not. Is there any difference in total carbon storage? So what I did was a quick and dirty study in which we went in and we measured the understory and the overstory vegetation. This is on the no brush plot, so that's standing mass, biomass, rather carbon mass in the standing vegetation at about age 40, four decades old plantation. And then we took apart the forest floor and we got the OAI, the AEIOU horizons, and sometimes C, and then down to 20 centimeters soil depth. So that's what it looked like where it was trees only and some grasses and forest floor and dirt. So what do you think the other side, the control plot, looks like? Looks like about the same thing. No real difference, an awful lot of carbon in the shrubs, but no real difference in the organic horizons or in the surface mineral soil. So it's about a trade-off. You get about it, and it makes sense. Leaf area is leaf area is leaf area. Photosynthesis is photosynthesis, and it all depends how you want it apportioned. So it really hasn't done much, at least down to 20 centimeters in terms of carbon storage. So let's look at other places. That was a pretty crummy site. Here's a much better site, about two-thirds, again, more water. This is our experimental forest at Challenge. Bill Oliver in the 60s put in an initial spacing study with ponderosa pine. That's where it's located in the Sierra Nevada, West Slope Sierras. And he put in a series of spacings that were differing by about 3 foot spacings, from 6 by 6 initial spacing, 6 by 6 feet, up to 18 by 18 feet at 3 foot intervals. So if you can all think in English units briefly. So that's what the understory controlled study looked like at about 40 years, trees only and some grasses and forest floor, happy trees. And this is what the adjacent split plot looked like. It's now, you got a closed canopy and shaded out the understory brush, but there's a lot of carbon in the brush. But it's had 40 years for that understory influence to develop. So what I did is I went back to that spacing design and I selected the narrowest spacing, the intermediate spacing, and the widest spacing. So 1.8 meters square spacing up to 5.5 square meters square space. Is Christy Siegel here? If not, she's probably worn out because she was working for me then and she helped sample the vegetation. And the first thing I'm going to show you is just the forest floor material where brush was absent. Trees only at the various spacings, 1.8 meters being the narrowest, 5.5 meters being the widest. No understory brush, just trees. And you can see that after almost three decades that there's a decline in O horizon material as you get to wider and wider spacings. And that makes sense. On the widest spacings, I haven't closed canopy yet. So there's less material stored in the forest floor. But now we go to the veg not controlled plots, and we signed that it's pretty much a wash across the site. Spacing didn't matter. If you got the understory vegetation, it fills in. It's dumping stuff on the forest floor. There's about the same amount of carbon on the forest floor. So it's kind of a wash as whether intensive management did anything there in terms of carbon storage above ground anyway. Now we're going to another experiment. This is sort of an intermediate site quality. This is one of my Garden of Eden sites, not too far from my office. If you ever out visiting me, well, I'll be happy to take you to that place. What we did there is we started from scratch. This was a brush field that was converted to a plantation, and we put in a series of kind of heroic treatments from do nothing to do a lot. And this is what the site looked like after the first growing season. It's an Aiken series. It's getting to be on the worn out stage. It's about a 25,000-year-old soil volcanic mud flow. So that's at time zero. Then without veg control at 15 years, it looked about like that. And with veg control, it looked like that at the same time. It's now reached 21 years. We're taking the stand apart, doing final destructive sampling, doing total below ground analysis on coarse roots as well as fine. And so at 15 years, we also did some biomass analysis. This is what it looks like. And the first thing we're going to look at, and this is largely work that was done by Karis McFarlane, who'll be presenting a paper that touches on this tomorrow, so I won't steal a lot of thunder from Karis, but she didn't separate pine roots from other stuff. If roots was roots, and this would be fine roots in the profile, for the control treatment, herbicide, fertilize, and herbicide plus fertilize. So you can say the control treatment actually had the smallest mass of fine roots. This is megagrams of carbon per hectare. Now we add in the forest floor. Again, there's a management effect. The more intensive management, the greater the mass of the forest floor. Didn't matter whether it was understory present or absent, still massive forest floor. And then you add in the overstory, and it's, you know, obviously, as I think some speakers have pointed out, the story is in the standing vegetation. So intensive management undoubtedly influenced above ground carbon storage. But then you add in what's in the soil, and we actually seem to have an effect on concentrations of carbon in the surface profile. But in fact, the amount in the above ground masses is dwarfed by the amount of carbon in the soil. And the assumption in all of these things we've been talking about is that that stuff is going to stay there or be used for a useful product. And maybe that's so and maybe it's not. So the conclusion so far is that short-term gains in carbon storage from vegetation management are minor. You can put it in brush or you can put it in trees, but it's about the same amount of carbon. And therefore, there's really no major incentive to practice intensive management in plantation forestry as an ecological service. So, you know, is that correct, or is there more to the story than that? Well, I think there is more to the story than that. The world is a hot place, and poor old California is sitting right out there on the edge of things. But, you know, in the meantime, but tomorrow's going to be sunny and warm, so don't worry much about it. But any way you look at it, fire is in the picture. And the question is, does intensive management do anything for you in terms of keeping carbon on the site? So any way you look at it, a big chunk of carbon going into the atmosphere comes from fires. And it's not just CO2, it's carbon monoxide, and it's methane as well. So what are the consequences of benign neglect, of doing nothing in plantation management in terms of retaining carbon on the site? And what I'm going to do now, and how are we doing for time here, Chris? Go to what I think is one of the oldest designed experiments of veg control, no veg control, across a couple of site qualities, soil qualities, in the state. It's one that I put in very early in my career in the mid-70s. This was a plantation that was established following a wildfire and brush clearing. And the interesting thing about this place is it's a geologic contact between a relatively recent volcanic mud flow and a much older metasedimentary soil that's about 250,000 years old. It's been uplifted, and they're right next to each other. Burned at the same time, same climate, same everything, planted at the same time, and the difference is soil quality. So the question is, does intensive management buy you anything if soil quality changes? So this was called the Balderston Plantation, and that's the poorer site quality. That's a site index estimated at about 11 meters at 50 years. Only the Forest Service would manage something like that, and sure enough they did, or BLM would too if they were lucky. But this is a Mariposa series, and it's a haplozeral, and it's skeletal. And I got involved with it when it was 9 years old, and I put in a series of treatments with and without nitrogen at different rates and with and without understory control. So that's what it looks like about a year after I got involved on the poor soil. This is the better soil right next door to it there. Much better site index, estimated at 24 meters at 50 years. And the question is, what's this buy you in the long run? And we found out in the short run it buys you a lot of volume. But does everything sort of catch up in time? Well, this is the crummy soil 28 years after treatment. And the National Forest protected this site for me, which was good. They didn't put a horse trail through it like they did a lot of other places. So that's the crummy site with veg control 28 years later. It's now 30 some odd, nearly 40 years old. And this is the control plot right next to it, same time. And these were all replicated treatment plots. So, you know, you got wall-to-wall vegetation in both cases, and the question is, how long is it going to stay there? This is the better site on that nice recent volcanic flow. With brush removal and without brush removal. In both cases, you got a closed canopy forest. The difference is, on the left on the control plot, you have a dead understory that has a fuel ladder that's connecting at least the lower parts of the trees if a wildfire came through. So what? Should we make a wildfire happen or do some modeling? Well, we thought it would be more of a politic to do some modeling, so we applied Behave Plus, a popular off-the-shelf model to this sort of thing. We said, well, In that control plot on the crummy soil, what would happen if a wildfire came through? Let's look at flame length, and we find, well, the flame length is averaging about 5.5 meters tall. Well, so what? Well, the so what is that plantation is probably only about 4 meters tall, so any way you look at it, it's cooked. So what happens if we do bread veg control early on? We drop that flame length down to less than a meter, as estimated by Behave Plus. This is the better soil. Flame length now, scale is much different now. Now we're talking about something that's less than 2 meter flame length if you don't do anything on the control plot. If you do something, remove brush early on, it hasn't really changed it much, but it's still a very short flame length. And when you put it all together, you look at the crummy soil, the Mariposa, we've reduced fat maximum flame length by early intervention by about 85%. We've really dropped it down. We now have a ground fire going through. That's also affected the rate of fire spread by about almost 90%. And it's affected the area burned in 2 hours, which is a big deal, how much time you have to get on top of the fire, by almost 100%. On the better site, we haven't reduced flame length much, but it wasn't much to begin with. But the other factors, the other parameters, have really been reduced. By early intervention, we've affected the rate of fire spread and the time we have to get in and control it. We don't have a crown fire in this situation. Either case, with vegetation control, no crown fire. So the conclusion is that it may not have much influence. Intensive management may not have much influence on above-ground carbon storage if you count everything, but it has a profound effect on how long that carbon stays there. And that's, in a Mediterranean system, I think that's everything. And I think that's the argument we can make in a state that's more regulated than any place you can imagine, like California, for practicing forestry and practicing intensive management. That plantation, incidentally, is the oldest, as far as I know, the oldest successful ponderosa pine plantation in the world. That was planted in 1919. And it's still standing today. It's had multiple entries. It's had prescribed fire in the underburns in it, and it's still cooking along. And it's an absolute average site quality. So, yeah, I think there's a real promise for, if you're going to have plantations, manage them so they don't burn up. Because if it goes up in smoke, all this rest of the stuff we've been talking about really doesn't matter an awful lot. So thank you for your attention.
I think we'll go into the discussion now, and I'd like to introduce Rich Birdsey of the Northern Research Station in U.S. Forest Service and head of the Northern Global Change Program, and he'll be moderating the discussion. Originally, we were going to have everybody come up here, but I think maybe the stage would collapse if we tried that, so try something different.
Yeah, we'll try it from here. We have about 15 minutes before everybody goes off to have something to eat. I thought it was a great set of talks. I think it's first just see if there's any burning questions. I know during the talks there were hands went up and just couldn't quite get your question in. So does anyone have a question, particularly if it is a fairly broad one that might address the question posed for this symposium, which was, can forest soils be used for carbon credits or registries? So first off, anybody like to ask a question, any of the speakers? Or trying to answer that broadly? Yeah.
I asked one question about Howard about the California Action Fire Registry. You said there were 600 or 700 people that had signed up. But were those really forestry offset projects? Because the registry vote is just reducing emissions from your stacks as well as forestry offset.
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. No, these are people that promised to turn off the lights and they're going to have more energy efficient cars. So forestry was a small part of that thing. But recently, Region 5 of the Forest Service signed on to this thing. And I think they're also thinking going to fuel-efficient cars, but they forget their damn forests are burning up every year, you know, and largely through lack of aggressive management. And that's the problem. So there's the other side of it. Now, this is mostly, it's if we ever really do have regulation, these people want to be granddaddy in, and that's the bottom line.
There's not been too many will manage forests this way to offset carbon.
No, and I think maybe some of the industry groups have signed on. The only one I know of is Collins Pine, who's a very conservative, uneven age management outfit, so they're not losing much to begin with, one way or the other.
Right, they sort of made a big splash. I thought they were the first and still the only forestry carbon offset project.
Yeah, but you know, and the bottom line is you've got to come up with a good way of bookkeeping on this sort of thing, and they're still working the bugs out of that. But it's a good cottage industry. There'll be people that hire on these consultants to monitor this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So they're still working on that. That's a critical thing. Again, I think it's all going to burn up anyway if you're not careful.
Other questions for any of the speakers? Right here.
I'd like to, I don't mean to continue to belabor one point here, but I did bring up the issue of rather than looking at the generalizations of the forest or looking at conifers and larges, specific species I think do play an important role. And I brought up the issue of red alder. And Dan Binkley, who I normally look to as my greatest ally, is not here to perhaps second my point that I'd be making. But really, under red alder, and this is almost invariably any alder site to look at, but in a very short time, you not only get a lot of nitrogen in the system, but you can basically double the low ground carbon levels. And that's brought about by two issues, I believe. One is that, as a matter of fact, under red alder, the decomposition rates are actually lower than they would be under that cycle in their aquifer, not higher. And secondly, the added carbon is there because of the large amount of nitrogen in the animal food. And I think there's a nexus there, and that is we have to not look at just the general thing, but we have to get aware of what's called hotspots, and where can we really identify potential sites where we could suppress their water carbon. And there's water bill.
Yeah. No, it's a. I'm not going to try to repeat all that, but the general comment was we really do need to begin looking at individual species effects and not just general categories of conifers versus hardwoods. And I know in the South there's some evidence that loblolly pine and longleaf pine have quite different quantities of carbon stored, where areas that were once native longleaf pine plantations have been converted to loblolly pine. And both sequester longleaf both sequesters more carbon, and is more resistant to damage from hurricanes and fires. So if you look at the longevity issue that Bob brought up, which is a very important one, you really do have to think about this over a long time period. Any other questions? I have a remark or two. If not, well, I came here looking for some answers. I think I probably have more questions now than I came here. I guess that's the way research works, though, right? You learn a little thing, and then it just leads to a few more questions. I did think the very interesting sampling and monitoring. It seems like the variability is very unpredictable. You know, it's not like you can walk into a stand of trees, you get a quick look at the density, the size, the distribution, and you can adjust your sampling. Forest soil seem to be a little bit more unpredictable, so you almost have to wait until you get your results before you know if you have any shot of doing a good job. I did like Dale's auger, though. That looks great after sponsoring quite a lot of quantitative soil pits the last couple of years. That seems pretty interesting to follow up on. I didn't hear a lot about models except from our Canadian colleague, but since the effects that we saw from many of these experimental treatments seem kind of unpredictable, you know, sometimes you get more carbon, sometimes less, it makes me wonder whether how much you can really achieve with models. You know, you run a model, you look at the results, you get a nice line, and you can see these trends, but compared with the experiments or observations, I'm forced to conclude that the impacts of management and are almost defy being generalized to the point where we could use a model or a series of models. Nonetheless, we need to keep working on that because if it's difficult to sample and monitor, the alternative is to have some really good models to use. But if we don't have those, we're kind of left with some trouble. Some of the questions I have with regard to registries, most of them require annual reporting. So that implies a fairly rigorous monitoring system. How do you make annual estimates in soils? You have slow pools, fast pools. Do you use a model for one? Do you model the other? Question here.
Really, the annual estimates are just to say that the forest hasn't burned out. yeah. All you're required to do, just say it hasn't been hit by pine needle, it hasn't been, you know, I said it was going to be forest, but it's still forest.
Mm-hmm.
I think they differ in their requirements on the annual reporting. It's not actually on the ground inventory every year.
Yeah. But at some point, you need to have a real number of what the gain was, and maybe that's every 5 or 10 years. But if you're trading some carbon in between those periods when you really have to have a good number, then you might have to go in and you know, make an annual estimate if you're attributing that carbon to a specific owner or a specific transaction. Another related question, how might we separate out the effects of natural disturbance from intentional management effects? Or how do we factor out climate variability? Some of the carbon pools seem to react rather quickly to climate effects or management, some not. So, you know, we're often trying to attribute these responses to a human action. In other words, what's the specific response to what you did to create this additional carbon, and so to focus on that issue. I didn't hear much about that, but it sort of came out in some of the talks. I don't know if anyone has any ideas about how we might do that. Yeah.
Well, I have a question related to that. Dale made the emphasized how storage and carbon storage and biomass are a lot more efficient than nitrogen. So there's also short-term conclusions might differ when disturbance is being put in fire or some other disturbance. So does that alter the equation of where, over the longer term, when disturbance is included, say fire or something else, where the more efficient the storage are?
Let me ask me.
Anyone?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And then, well, after fire and scare people, it's no brushing day when Bob's talking about the soil nitrogen goes up. Presumably, it's a better burn again. So we have better forest production. But the problem is the burn again. So what is the minimal burning? Is it burned open over? Is it care how much soil nitrogen goes? Well, that's a real, seems to be a real wild card.
Comment in the back.
I just got these guys a really quick question. It's one of the concerns that's in the wildlife community. During a forest fire, does nitrogen combust stoichiometrically in the same ratio as does carbon?
Just about.
Yeah. Pretty much, doesn't it? Yep.
Yeah, it actually burns off first. It starts going at 200 degrees, about 500 degrees is gone. Well, I see two things. There's carbon still there. Where does this flush of mineralization come from that follows the fire? This flush of nitrogen mineralization.
Probably some of it's microbial either assimilation from ash, and then also what the CBD reactors in terms of other soil. Also, you can have some partial decomposition of the organic material. And there's some devastating stone. Depending on the fire severity, if it's low severity, a lot of nitrogen hangs around. High severity, close to the bottom line. So it's all the other thing. And then once you get roots, you've got roots being every spine on, all the other roots. It all functions severity.
Okay, so most of you know the Forest Service chief set out some goals for the nation with regard to carbon sequestration. Essentially, Chief Kimball proposed that the nation double the amount of offset in forests from about 10% currently, offset of fossil fuels, to 20% by 2020. I happen to know where that 10% number came from, and it doesn't do a very good accounting for soil carbon, by the way. It's it only partially accounts for that, but for all the reasons we've heard today, there's simply not a good system in place in the United States to really come up with a good quantitative estimate for the whole country, wall to wall, all the forests, of what's going on with soil carbon. So that's certainly a problem. But in order to meet that goal of doubling carbon sequestration in forests, we probably need to do a little bit better accounting for the carbon in soils. And there's two things. One, it might be going the other way. So maybe we think we're sequestering a lot more carbon in the ecosystem if we're only counting the trees and the woody debris and so on and the wood products. But the soil may be behaving a little differently. So, what's more important? Maybe not knowing. Do we want to accept the uncertainty of simply not knowing what's going on with soil carbon, or do we really want to try to make a push to get better estimates? And this goes across scales. So from the registry and the carbon trading point of view, we need to really have a better sense of the response to specific practices as they happen at small enough scales that people manage at. But on the other hand, we have this large goal. So we really need to work both ways. So I'd certainly just like to send out the challenge to this community to continue working along these lines to improve our estimates. And maybe the next time I come to one of these meetings, I'll hear a few more answers to the questions. Anyways, I'd like to thank this. Oh, wait, we got a comment here.
I just wanted to make a comment. Sure. I think that we're looking at this thing wrong. We're worried about how much carbon is in soil. When any model of net impact on the global carbon cycle, soil is really important as a producer of biomass. And that biomass needs to be harvested. For instance, Bob's forests, the difference between them really is the one that they'll take logs off of and put them in economy and substitute for iron and for steel and concrete and stuff, that's going to have a much bigger impact. So keeping our soils productive and producing products that go into our economy is really the only thing that's important in this. Clearly, if we really change the pools, that could be an issue, but we're not changing them nearly as much as we're pumping carbon dioxide into the air from air industrial processing. And wood is very, very efficient. Concrete and steel are not. So that is really, in my mind, the issue.
Well, I tend to agree with that. I think accounting for the wood products and the substitution is a critical part and is likely over the long term to store a lot of carbon off-site where it's being produced. I really liked Bob's concluding remarks, though, that how long the carbon can stay on site perhaps may be as critical as, if not more critical, than the small relative difference we're seeing in a lot of these treatments. So, another comment. Oh, now we're getting going here. Yeah, I think that's a great point, and myself and others throw these terms around pretty loosely. I often talk about just good carbon management, which is probably very similar to what people think of as sustainability. And it might mean less carbon in some systems than we currently have, and it might mean more in others. But I think the notion of not considering that is probably not the best thing to do either, particularly. Well, we might be looking at avoiding deforestation as a mechanism, and so then you're comparing, a housing development with a working forest, let's say. So there are, I think these all need to. I don't think you can take things off the table And I don't know if you've probably all seen the sort of the wedges from Harvard, you know, that you look at a lot of little actions, but eventually they add up to a big effect. So even I think the smallest potential action needs to be considered. We have one here and then back there.
What's worth pointing out, I've been to meetings in 2 years ago in Washington, where engineers are talking about, let's put a lot of carbon in the soil, you know, put it in there. So what about the seed and the ratio? Well, what do we care about that? So if they put carbon in the soil, soda, 16 and ratio 200, that means nothing. And everybody in this room knows that that is going to be a real problem. We're pointing that out to an uninitiated. Some of these people run the program who never had a course in soil science, but can't put carbon without any nitrogen. They forget all about it. 20 years ago, everybody's worried about fish saturation. Now nobody cares about it. It's all about carbon. And you just want to put carbon in and nothing else, and fish can be really good at both.
Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree completely. With your point is that we need to remember that the forests in this case are serving three purposes, and we have to figure out where we do each one of them. So one is the carbon storage, deforestation for other uses. Non-working forest lands represents one of the major losses of carbon, at least in the northern hardwood forest. We've done some of that, figuring out how much that is. That's your 10% right there for the forests in the northeastern region.
Probably,
of the
yeah.
U.S. And that's not building the houses, that's simply moving around on the landscape. So that's one piece. The other one is fuels. We're getting a big push on fuels. What fuels, what form of the fuels, and how much you go to fuels, and how much you go to product. And it's a balancing of all three of those factors that we need to do in thinking about carbon on these landscapes. And it isn't, as you say, it's the wedges, it's all of them, it's not one of them. We have to remember that we tend to go one way or another. It's not simply product.
Yeah.
But it's fuels and product, low quality wood going into fuel substitution, which is your biggest offset in most cases, more so than product. And then, of course, avoided deforestation and managing some systems for protected land.
Yep. Back here.
And I'm surprised Bob didn't mention it, but it's more of a glass half full scenario. Those of us that deal with plantation culture, all the results are, again, pretty positive. Or is it hard to push these forests to improve productivity? You know, I would look at Bob's stuff and said, on the good side, we don't decrease carbon. You know, so we can manage these things as intensively as we want to maintain soil carbon, to maintain productivity, and if we can do that, you know, we can supply forest products and we can run into them and maintain the ecosystem services that these forests provide, which is a really positive response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of groups are coming to realize that having a managed forest is certainly better than no forest at all. So, anyways, last chance for comments. Bob.
Yeah, this
last
is just,
word.
Just to be the last word. Nick Chappell, I don't know if Nick is still here, but he mentioned something to me this morning, and I thought, yeah, this is a good point. I am personally responsible for major carbon sequestration because there was a time when Vic Timmer visited me and he asked me to send in some pine cones. And we have these giant cones in California, so I think I sent you some giant cones and you said that the faculty all grabbed them. And those babies are stored at room temperature at very low humidities, I'll bet you. And I'll bet you they haven't lost one molecule of carbon all the time. So I think if we send each other the pine cones, we can do our share.